On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. Howard Chudikoff is not an expert on child rearing. He's not a child psychologist. He's an historian. And when he sat down to study the history of child's play in America, poring over diaries, letters, interviews of boys and girls from the New York Island to the Redwood Forest, rich, poor, slave, free, he found one common theme. Play was about a world away from the adults, and not about adult-run playdates. This hour, On Point, Child's Play in America, Then and Now. Joining me now in the studio is Howard Chudikoff. He's a professor of American history at Brown University and author of the new book, Children at Play, An American History. And nice to have you with us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me on your program.
Thank you. Parents always worry that they're doing the right things for their kids, and we'll get to that all shortly. But I wanted you to first address, more broadly speaking, the question of what history tells us about child's play in this country.
Sure, I'd be glad to. I really got interested in children's culture, particularly the way that children crafted their own play through the ages and how they sometimes abided by what adults wanted them to do, but also about how they created alternative and sometimes oppositional ways of playing. We have to remember, of course, that throughout almost all of American history and throughout human history, children have worked more than they have played in the fields and in the home, as well as later on in the factories. Yet they've also played as part of their work, stolen time or making up games while they worked. But then, of course, they also sought their own ways of entertaining themselves in the time that they had away from work, sometimes within the family and sometimes without. So over the last 300 years or more of American history, I guess almost 400, I've seen both continuities and changes. Continuities in the ways that children have always tried to act creatively, to work out their own ways of entertaining themselves, and also to play with each other and within their families. But of course, there have been big changes in several different aspects.
And those are what?
One would be the environment in which children have played. If you think of a rural society in which children roamed the fields and the forests, and they used nature as part of the playthings or the play sites where they entertain themselves. Second has been the big change in the material culture of childhood, toys. Back in the colonial period, a toy was not necessarily something that was only for children. They were baubles that could be collected, not so much used, but could be for adults as well as for children. And the third thing, of course, has to do with the control of children's play and the time that they've had to play.
And so this notion of directing and controlling and enriching a child's play is really a modern phenomenon.
Yes, it is. But also, I mean, adults have always wanted to protect and to control children's play, but for different reasons. One was to, in pre-modern times, to make sure that children were not idle or idling away their time, and that so whatever they were doing to entertain themselves was productive. But as the 19th century progressed and we began to see childhood as a separate and precious time of life, more and more indulgence came along, and that play becomes the role, the particular function for the lives of children. But play also had to have a function. That is, there were experts who say, well, a child's play is the child's work because it should lead to something. But that's the adult view of it.
Well, then, so talk about that. So define exactly how a child sees play and how that's different from how an adult sees play.
There's a quote in my book, Children at Play, An American History, from Tom Sawyer, in which Tom Sawyer says, as he's lecturing one of his friends, that work consists of something that you're obliged to do.
Mm-hmm.
Play is something that you're not obliged to do. Play can be anything, running through the forest, playing leapfrog, not just making games, and certainly not playing with toys, because in the modern era, we really connected play with toys. But what I was really found that over the last several decades, in terms of the time that children have to play and the control of their play, here has been one of the biggest declines, that the abilities of children to have unstructured, free, creative play, the time that they have for that, really among all classes, but of course, especially among the middle class and people of means, that time has been reduced considerably. And adults, in the terms, I don't use the term, but some other people have used it, adults have invaded the child's world to structure their time with all kinds of activities that really they're obliged to do in Tom Sawyer's terms.
In fact, the quote in the book that I liked so much was, "Kids should have their own world and parents are a nuisance." So where do you draw the line if you're a parent and you think that getting down on the floor, I mean, I've had a pediatrician tell me that I should be down on the floor with my child playing for at least 20 minutes a day, one-on-one, quality time. I mean, what do you say?
We like to follow prescription, don't we? You know, I have to demur that I'm not a parenting expert, and it's really hard for me to give advice. But what I've seen over the years, especially in reading the diaries and the autobiographies and the sources that I use about ordinary people, is that children often resent parental interference, especially the preteen ages that I've been mostly concerned with, ages 6 to 12, what Freud called real childhood. Now, obviously, parents want to guide what their children are doing, and children actually want that kind of guidance, but they also want some kind of independence. The play has often been a quest for autonomy.
Well, gone are the days when, you know, you used to send your child out, and we'd disappear for an hour or two or longer, you know, and we'd be kicking the can down the street or collecting sticks. You know, now it's about play dates, and parents go to the play date with their child, and it's all structured, and we have a class every day after school, and we help with homework. You know, how did parents come to be so intrusive, if you will, based on what your research is showing?
The society became more aware of the precocity, the preciousness of children. We also then became obsessed with sheltering them, with protecting them from danger. Now, certainly there are dangers out there, and maybe they're more acute than they had been in the past, or maybe we're just aware of them because the media publicized them so much. But child protection is something that goes along with child guidance and the teaching of children. It's kind of interesting when people of my advanced years ask me, what have been the big changes that you've seen in children's play? And I throw back a question at them, and I say, well, when you were a kid, what color was your bicycle helmet? And they say, I didn't have any bicycle helmet. We didn't have any of that kind of protective gear and all that whole notion that you had to be protected from any kind of injury, any kind of risk, any kind of danger. And so I think it's a fact that today it's much harder for children to take risks.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that may be good in some ways, but I think it's counterproductive in others.
You say in your book that play should serve as a child's way of asserting autonomy.
Mm-hmm.
Explain that.
Children... That's what I mean by the ways in which children have resented play. You know, I came across numerous quotations in these diaries and autobiographies where people were saying, adults don't understand us. And they don't. You know, they think that everything that a child does has to have some sort of productive, some positive consequence. whereas they don't give an opportunity to children simply to lie on the grass and look up at the clouds and imagine the formations of the clouds becoming some kind of story. Or one of the real inspirations for what I wrote about was this bestseller in the 1950s by a humorist named Robert Paul Smith. And the book was called, Where Did You Go? Out. What Did You Do? Nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that title says it all mm-hmm. about how children want their own independence and how they don't want adults, they don't want parents to be a part of that. And so Smith, in his kind of exaggerated way, talked about adults as being the natural enemies of children mm-hmm. because they wanted to intrude, they wanted to control them.
We're looking at how children play and whether they play better and grow up better if you, the parent, leave them the heck alone. My guest is Howard Chudikoff, professor of American history at Brown University and author of the new book, Children at Play, in American History. I'd like to bring another voice into the conversation. David Lancey is a professor of anthropology at Utah State University and author of the forthcoming book, The Anthropology of Childhood, Cherubs, Chattel, and Changelings. Nice to have you with us, Professor.
Thank you, Jane.
So from an anthropological perspective, what's your reaction to what you've heard so far from Professor Chudikoff?
Well, from the anthropological record, one sees much the same thing Dr. Chudikoff describes. That is, you don't see parents playing with children. You do see children playing on their own, independently.
So how much alone time is too much alone time then on the flip side?
In cultures that I have studied, once fathers may have absolutely nothing to do with their children, and mothers, aside from nursing them, pass them off to older siblings to look after or to granny to look after, may have next to nothing to do with it with the children, especially not playing with them.
Mm-hmm. How much has the modern age changed all of this, you know, the educational toys and really, you know, fear of sending your kids out to play in the street, among other things?
We call it the demographic transition, where there was this dramatic drop in the birth rate. But I think we've gone even beyond that, where now it's not just that people are only having two children and therefore much more riding on those two children, but they're having them later in life, and they're having vasectomies and so on to terminate their childbearing. So you get only two opportunities for perfection, so to speak. Whereas in more traditional societies with very large families, there's bound to be a few that don't turn out so well. So it's the law of averages, and that's just fine.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Chudikoff, how much of this must be individualized for your own child? You know, some kids need more time alone. Some kids need more time with a parent. How much does it just depend on your child?
Boy, that's a good question. I can't say that I've done any psychological studies on this, and I think you're right. It certainly does depend on the individual. And I think Professor Lancey is quite right in that we have fewer individuals now to deal with, and how much has to be determined, I guess, by the parents themselves.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Professor Lancey may disagree or may agree. My book includes some perspectives on the ways that American Indian children played, and you certainly see a difference there between the white children and the Indian children in regard to sex roles, and particularly the ways that the fathers left the Indian boys to play alone and to experiment and learn how to be warriors and parents, whereas the girls played with their mothers mm-hmm. or within yeah. the work that their mothers were doing simultaneously with them.
Mm-hmm. You can generalize that to the whole world.
Mm.
I think that's right, yeah.
Well, in fact, in your book, Dr. Chudakov, you talk about the difference in play in across all spans, age, sex, social class, and you say that there's been a very important shift. You mentioned American Indian boys. You say there's been an important shift in how boys in our modern age and in our modern culture play. Mm-hmm. What is that?
Boys no longer play in the way that trains them to be fathers and workers. You know, we still do have Tinker Toys and Erector sets and Lincoln Logs around, but they have lost in popularity to character action heroes that boys have become, and girls to a certain extent too, have become very much influenced by the backstory of media, movies, television programs, and they're all intertwined. I mean, you can go into a Toys R Us or any big box children's store these days. And sure, they still have a lot of the old traditional toys, but the front shelves include the toys about Spider-Man, about Barbie, about Superman, and the everything that's connected with media, so that there's an entertainment context for toys, formal toys, commercial toys today, that includes media, all of the TV, movies, toys. They're all intertwined. And playing with the toys requires knowledge of this backstory.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to know what the who the characters are, mm-hmm. what their background is, what their adventures are, and all of that. And once you know that, then it's probable that kids will play with the toys for only a certain amount of time.
Mm-hmm. And then look for the next good thing.
And then move on to the next good thing.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas traditional play, also, you know, kids create their own stories, but it has a continuity and a creativity to it, mm-hmm, that mm-hmm. Is confined by the media today.
Let me turn to the anthropologist, Dr. Lacey. What's your take? I'm sorry.
Lancey.
Tell me what your take is on the media and how that's affected and changed how a child has played over time.
Well, I think that's an interesting point, that construction toys are less popular. It's almost as if modern children's play is escapist. So if we imagine the life of a child thoroughly programmed from sports to violin lessons to school, the play functions for them now the way it does for adults, to escape from the grind, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phones, because we have so many parents lining up wanting to ask some questions here. Catherine is in Charleston, South Carolina. Hi, Catherine. You're on the line.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
How are you?
Good.
Great. I have a question for Dr. Judicon that I love what he's saying. And what I'd like to know in this day and age is how, as parents, with how we are trying to protect our children from all these things we see on the media and whatnot, how can we foster that play, that alone time, for so that they can actually do this, so this balance of playing alone and you know, the eyes of our adults, you know, make things safe and work in both places.
Catherine, thanks so much for calling. Dr. Chudakov?
Well, again, I'm not a child advice expert, but I guess I would throw back a question to you, and that is, how much risk do you want, and I mean you in a broad sense, mm-hmm. do we want our children to take? My friends who have done a little bit of research on this tell me that the actual incidences of child abduction and child molestation have not really changed over the last century, but we know so much more about them, so we're fearful about protecting our children. If you exclude factory and work accidents, the incidences of child injuries outside of work and outside of school have actually declined. But we feel that, you know, we've got to protect our kids from, whether it's scraping their elbow or breaking a finger or whatever, that we have to take every precaution. Now, we sure do read about in the media about really horrible things that happen to kids as a result of playing with toys or on the playground or someplace else like that. But overall, children are far safer, even on their own today, than they ever have been in the past.
In our modern era, from your research, from the histories that you've pulled together for your book, Children at Play, this overscheduling and overorganizing, how much of it has come down to parents and their own guilt? All the other parents are taking their kids to art and music and spending hours helping them with homework. And if I don't do it, my kid won't turn out and you know, I'm a bad parent. How much of this
Absolutely.
Is the guilt?
Yeah, we feel now ever more than in the past that we have to enrich our kids' lives. And the only way to do that is to structure their world with some kind of instructional enrichment, whether it's karate lessons or computer lessons or French or gymnastics, and that we have to keep them in shape by making them go to soccer leagues where they can learn also teamwork and how to interact with others. And part of that is because we don't have the spaces where children can play on their own like they used to. I mean, the sources that I used talked about and reminisced about backyards and vacant lots and even the streets. But now in our urbanized society and even our suburban society, a lot of those sites are gone.
Let's go to Linda, who has a call from Spokane, Washington. Hi, Linda. Welcome.
Hey.
Hi.
I was saying I have four children. My two oldest, we were living in the suburbs, and our house was not far from the street, and they had a very different childhood. I took them to music, I took them to all the sports, and then about 2 years ago we moved out to a farm, and my youngest two, who at the time were about 6 and 8, I just didn't have the time to take them to all the music and all the things. And they play out in the fields. They play out in the forest. Sometimes there's an hour that goes by where I know they're safe because we're in a very, very safe area. And they have turned, I have really noticed a difference between my two youngest and my two oldest. My two youngest are much more independent. They're much more confident. They just seem like they're happier than when I had my oldest two doing everything. And my oldest one is now in college, and I can see there's a level of tension in that child that I don't see in my youngest two.
Linda, great call. Thank you. Thank you very much for your perspective, Dr. Chudikoff.
I work a lot with student athletes at college, and it's kind of interesting to see that a good number of them, by the time they reach a certain age, they are burned out because their parents have been pushing them into a sport. Now they do it year-round, even the same sport that used to be seasonal. And they see their play and their youth as it had been work, and it wasn't fun. And they liked it while they were doing it, but they got tired of it because they were so structured, so pressured to do to excel at this sport. So that by the time they get to be 18 or 19 year old, they've had enough.
They've had enough. I was interested in your book, Dr. Chudikoff, when you talked about how children cultivate their own underground play when they don't get enough of their own alone time without their parents. Can you talk about that?
The underground can consist of things that adults don't know about or consist of things that adults don't like. But it's usually just a kind of harmless play. You know, you can hear a parent saying to a child who is sitting at home just imagining something or sitting under a table and using it as a fort or using it as a train or something like that, and the parent saying, "Why don't you go outside and do something? Why don't you go call up so-and-so and play?" Well, they probably would like to do that, but they also like to express their autonomy, to do something on their own, to experiment, You know, when do kids really have a time to experiment, to take risks, to learn on their own is when they're doing something by themselves, more so than when parents are saying, you've got to do this. Here's the way to do it. You got to go to this group, to this organization,
to
this
you.
Class, and I'm going to go with you and make sure you do it right.
Yeah. Donna is calling from Hopkinton, Massachusetts. Hi, Donna. Go ahead.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I work as a pediatrician in the Boston area, and I just couldn't agree more with what's been said today. I think we're doing a huge disservice to this generation of children that's being raised on play dates where one parent drives the child from one house to another, you know, extended day and after school sports, dance, music, etc. When kids are allowed to be out and go find somebody to play with and not have a structured plan and make up things along the way, there's just a huge amount of maturation that takes place, growth and development, creativity. You learn a lot of life lessons, how to solve fights, how to deal with bickering and conflict resolution and everything else. And I think that, you know, nobody walks to school anymore, and all of this change in child rearing is really contributing to I think the obesity problem that we see, the increasing anxiety that we see, which is well documented, and, you know, also just a loss of nature knowledge. You know, nobody knows what a blue jay sounds like anymore. I don't think those are insignificant things. And it's become a standard question for me now when I do well checkups on children. Do you live in a neighborhood that's child-friendly where you can let your children go out on their bikes and just find other kids to play with? And the answers I get are really surprising. I mean, a lot of parents are just, they've thrown in the towel, and they say what you said earlier, gone are the days where kids go out and play. You know, but other parents will tell me, oh, we bought our house before we had kids, and it's, you know, it's really expensive, it's lovely, it's quiet, it's a nice retirement home, but it's not a place to raise kids, really. And my comment to that is, you know, you're going to invest 18 years with your kids at home. You may want to think of moving or buy a less expensive home in a neighborhood with lots of kids, and that may be where our priorities ought to be today.
Dr. Donna, thank you. Thank you. From the pediatrician, we hear wise words. Dr. Chudikoff, what's the critical period, as you have studied the history of America at play among our children, the critical period of development in play?
I think the watershed was the 1950s, when television began to focus programming and advertising toward children. This leads to the media domination of play that I mentioned before. The Mickey Mouse Club was the first television program that featured kids, not just adults doing things for kids, but featured children. And Mattel, as the advertiser on the Mickey Mouse Club, was the first toy company to advertise every day of the year.
Right now, I'd like to bring into the conversation Dr. Stevan Auerbach. She is the author of Smart Play, Smart Toys, How to Raise a Child with a High IQ. Nice to have you with us, Dr.
Thank
Stevan.
Thank you. It's PQ, play quotient.
Right. Well, tell us what your response has been to what you've heard so far from Dr. Chudikoff and his research.
Well, it's so interesting to listen to it because, you know, play is really a microcosm of our society. It brings together every aspect of the issues of parenting and raising children, and it is a very interesting and very full subject. And everything that Dr. Chudikoff talked about, I wanted to interact with him and really discuss, you know, from the Mickey Mouse Club and Barbie, and here's recalls that are happening with the problem of toy safety.
Is it because you disagree with Dr. Chudikoff?
Well, there are things that I agree with, and there's other perceptions that I'd like to share, which is that play is really everywhere. It's really not limited. We really want to not make parents wrong because they're taking kids to piano lessons or any kind of training that they're getting, and whether they're good in sports, you know, it's how you do it. And what I really want to remind everybody is that we don't have training to be parents. The child doesn't come with a manual. And one of the reasons I did my book, From Baby to Age 12, is really to try to guide parents to relax about being the child's first big toy. You're the first interaction that the child has, and toys are not a substitute for your playing and interacting with your child. So I really try to to remind parents to enjoy all of the different aspects of play with their children and to give the child a chance to be alone, to play with other children, to play in whether it be organized activities and, just a balance of activity, not trying to be structured.
You know what our society is like, right, Doctor? I mean, these parents who smother their child with attention and the management of every waking hour.
Right. Well, that's what we don't want the helicopter parents that are hovering. We don't want smothering. We don't want neglect. We have a lot of families who are listening, like the pediatrician who is working parents, and they have a problem when they get home. They're tired. They think they immediately put on television, and that cuts out the conversation and the fun. So I say, turn off the television. Bring out a board game, play for a while, do something that's fun with the whole family to do together. And I try to remind parents to do something, a balance between active play, creative play, and educational
learning. And how about, as Dr. Chudikoff is saying, just send your kid outside and let him discover for himself?
That's part of it, too. You see, the child can play outside if your neighborhood allows for children to be safe outside. That's great. It's wonderful. One of the moms who called in from Spokane, you know, she can do that in where she lives because it's a more nature-related community. But not everyone can do that. So I don't want parents to feel they are somehow depriving their child because they can't play outside. I think the play is a very, very complex issue. And I don't want parents to feel they're wrong because they can't do something somebody else can do. But you can go to children's museums, you can go on nature walks, you can have time to be for the child to be alone and explore in nature. You may have to go with them to the park. They may not be able to go by themselves. But, you know, get out the cardboard boxes and let them explore and create things new. You know, somebody mentioned about the construction toys. They are wonderful, and they are popular. And I'm actually presenting a paper next month to a group of educators about the importance of construction toys.
Well, let me bring in Dr. Lancey one more time and have you respond to what Stefan Auerbach has just said, Doctor.
Oh, it's hard to disagree with anything that she is saying. The only cautionary note I think we need to sound is to reassure parents who do not enjoy playing with their children that their children will in no way be harmed by the absence of a parent playing with them.
Have a child, I think it's really important not just to feed them, not just to read stories to them, but to actually have fun with them. It's not about parenting at a distance. What happens when we play is that we're interacting. Brian Sutton Smith is one of the great scholars in this area, and he's a very playful person. And I feel that we as scholars, looking at as professionals, need to remember to play ourselves. You know, all of us need to do this. I think life in general gets very serious, and adults, you know, have been playing in offices, develop team building. We need to loosen up a little bit in as a society and maybe be a little bit more flexible, a little bit more improvisational in our lives.
Let me bring Dr. Chudikoff into this, Doctor.
Well, balance is always a great term. And I think Dr. Auerbach is very right about that, that we've got to try to achieve a balance. What kind of strikes me about some of the things that were just said is another consequence of our commercialized society is what the sociologists have called age compression, where we now have children who want certain kinds of commercial goods that older people have had, and we have older people who want the same goods.
Right.
So we talk about children who are 9 and 10 and 11 who want the iPods and the Game Boys and the computers and the cell phones and all of these adult toys. And we have 30, and you know, in CDs and music, we have 35-year-olds who want the same things.
Right. Well, that's what David Elkind said about disappearing childhood. You know, we really need to remind kids to turn off the electronics, because once electronics started, when television came in, I used to listen to the radio before, you know, there was television, and it was great for imagination and for listening to stories and
so on.
Yeah,
and television is much different. Doctor, I've got to interrupt you because I have so many callers who want to get in on this. Patrick is our first now in this segment from Buffalo, New York. Hi, Patrick, go ahead.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I had a question for your guests about time, because you're talking a lot about spending time with your kids, which is great if you have that choice. But a lot of people out there don't, and they're holding down, like, serious jobs. And, like, I don't have kids myself, but I know that's got to have some effect if you don't have that kind of time. Kids, you got to let them go on their own sometimes. I wonder what your callers thought about that.
Good point. Patrick, thanks so much for your call. Dr. Shudikov.
Well, that is an interesting point that we try to make sure that children's time is being watched over and is being used productively. You know, again, I would defer to others who are more expert about parenting. But
let me ask you, in conjunction with that, the differences that exist in play for children of a lower income bracket.
Yeah, I think that's a good point that we tend to overlook, that we take a very middle class view of these things. And children who don't have the means for the kinds of activities or the environments that we think are best, mm-hmm. have to deal with their own limitations. I think there are certain similarities that you still find, you know, lower-income kids have some of the same toys, have some of the same electronic gadgets. They may not be quite as elaborate, right. May not be quite as expensive, but they can play the same ways. Also, parents find that to keep these kids safer, they have to put them in front of the television set,
right.
and let them occupy their time mm-hmm. that way,
one of
rather
the
than putting
like
them out on the street.
Is a toy right. library. In communities, there is an association of toy libraries. You know, just like we loaned books, you can loan toys. So children who are low income can still play with some of these great toys and borrow them and use them like library books, you know, and bring them back.
Mm-hmm.
So toy
mm-hmm.
libraries are a great way to do this. And, you know, one of the concerns that I've had, something that goes against play, is that schools have cut out recess, have cut out a lot of the after-school programs that are really enrichment in the arts and music and theater and so on. And these are the kinds of things that children need everywhere, whether low-income or middle-income or whatever.
Yeah.
So they all need to play in different ways and find their multiple intelligences, all the different ways that they can learn.
Here's another voice on this particular issue, Middletown, Connecticut, and Amy, who's calling from there. Hi, Amy. Go ahead.
Hello, Jane.
Hi.
Yes, I do have a couple of comments. We recently, as a family, moved to a much quieter street. We've lived on a very, very busy, actually, state highway, in fact, in a cul-de-sac neighborhood. Our son, the growth in his social skills since doing so are remarkable. He has learned to work issues out by himself. He has learned to stand up for himself, say no and mean it, say yes and mean it. He's become a better friend. He has become independent. He's an 8-year-old with a diagnosed learning disability who is thriving. His reading has been positively affected by that, and family have been positively affected by that. Mm. We still absolutely pull out board games, and I find that to be so helpful, because we as a family, we're just three with one child,
mm-hmm.
have found that, you know, those are the times when you can laugh as a family and poke fun at one another in a healthy way.
Mm. Yes,
and,
exactly.
you know, remember and cherish those things. And I also want to add that, you know, coming from lower income, you know, we have dollar stores, and that's where I buy most of our play supplies, if you will. Mm. We do not have one electronic game in our home. Mm. I will not allow them, frankly.
Mm. Interesting. Amy, thank you. I want Dr. Chudikov to respond.
One of the interesting points that I think emerges from the study of children, if Dr. Auerbach, Dr. Lancey agree, is that children, we don't give children enough credit for
right.
the skills that they can do. You know, you can find a 9-year-old who can be playing a game, watching television, listening to music,
right.
and probably doing her homework all at the same time.
Multitasking.
And probably
yeah.
they can multitask
yeah.
better than we as adults
yeah.
can.
Let me go back to the phones. In Providence, Rhode Island, Jim is calling. Hi. Go ahead, Jim.
Oh, hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question was, or my comment was, I'm wondering about what they'd have to say about parenting styles changing through generations. I know that my grandparents were strict with my parents, so that now my parents were very easygoing with us as children, and now it seems as though with my children, I tend to be a little bit stricter because my parents weren't, and I wondered. I'll take my comment off the air. Thank you.
Okay, Jim, thank you. Dr. Chudikov.
Well, certainly this change in parenting comes about as different values about children have emerged and evolved over the years. It used to be, and maybe still is in parts of the country, where at nighttime parents would sit down with their children and they would read the Bible to them and play a moral kind of morality focused card game, as well as board games. Now, what do they do? I suppose they watch television together or not, and let children do have a lot of independence today because they have their own bedrooms. They have their own space mm-hmm. within the house mm-hmm. that they never had before, and mm-hmm. so they have a place where they can play with their toys away from adult supervision, and so that's a big change, too.
I have to ask you, Dr. Chudikov, this book, Children at Play, is so well-researched. It's so compelling on so many levels.
And, thank you.
And yet, you are not a parent yourself.
I am not. I have no children. I have nieces and nephews, and I have four grandnieces whom I have observed, of course.
And it's also the way you have some time to do
it. Yeah, I have some time to observe. And so I have a certain kind of distance.
Right.
I may not have the experience as a parent, but I have a distance from it that maybe gives me a certain kind of broader perspective mm-hmm. Of the present as well as the past than somebody who has been a parent.
Mm. You're an expert on history, Dr. Chudikov, so you've really looked at this from the perspective of history and applying the whole principles of play to the development over the time, of time frame.
That's what I've tried to do.
Let me go back for one more call before our hour is up. Dean is on the line from Hyde Park, Massachusetts. Go ahead, Dean.
Hi, you know, I'm listening to this conversation and I'm thinking about all these great home movies from the 50s that I've seen from my parents in my aunts and uncles' generation where, you know, you have two groups, one of which is the adults, you know, consisting of a lot of men in suits smoking cigarettes and well-coiffed women in these big colorful poofy dresses flitting around the kitchen and dining room. And then the other group is these kids in cowboy and Indian costumes, banging drums, playing with guns, and you're just kind of chaos in their own little world. And then I look at the pictures of my own family, my son and my sister's kids, just from the last couple of years, and there are all these pictures of adults down on the floor with the kids. So this conversation really resonates with what I've seen, and I can see the shift that's taken place.
Yes.
I guess my question is, a comment is that I think we need a history of parenting. Why has this shift taken place? What is the drive behind this sort of over-parenting and the need to supervise? Is it part of the culture wars? Is it sort of this extension of family values? Is it a changing perception in the landscape that we see the world as a more dangerous place?
Dean, thanks so much for your call. The clock is running up in conjunction with his question. I'd like to add my own as we wrap up this hour, the biggest lesson that you've learned, Doctor, as you have studied the history of play and what we need to learn as parents and as a culture about how we let our kids play.
Well, it's easy to look back in history and say, well, things were better in the past. But one of the things I think that emerges over time is that kids want to be kids, and they are really good at doing it. And whether it's in the 17th century or the 21st century, children remain creative, they remain fun, they may remain entertaining to watch, and they remain to learn on their own through their own devices, and let's hope that they still remain eager and skillful at becoming good adults.
Howard Chudikov, the book is Children at Play, An American History. How delightful to have you. I so enjoyed the book. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you very much.
Also with us, Dr. Stevan Auerbach, with us from Sacramento, and Dr. David Lancy, a professor of anthropology at Utah State University. Thanks to both of you as well.
Great. And don't forget to play today.
Thanks so much. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.